lecture was actually quite stiff, I thought. You know, I covered quite a lot of stuff. And it was all quite formal. You know, we did sort of a Euclidean gravity solution, you know, approach for thermodynamics. We looked at thermodynamics of Kerr, and we even looked at some thermodynamic volume. So there was a lot going on. There's still, you know, a fair bit of material in today's lecture, but it's slightly more mundane, hopefully, fingers crossed. And today what I really want to explore is to what extent, you know, you can get multi-black hole solutions. Now, if you have electrically charged black hole solutions, it is possible to get multi-black hole solutions where the sort of electrical repulsion is balanced by gravitational attraction. I'm not sure if Dave has got a tutorial planned on that, but anyway, that's not what I'm actually going to talk about today. Today I'm going to talk about something a little more interesting, which is we start off by looking at a sort of rather unpromising solution to the vacuum Einstein equations in the sense of it looks a bit opaque. It's not obvious what it is physically when we begin with it. But by slowly peeling up the covers on this solution, we'll sort of see how do we get sort of to the point of getting a physical interpretation of some metric that you just find. Okay, so how do you attack looking at a metric and seeing what it means? And in the process, we'll sort of discover that black holes can actually do more than just sit there, because what we'll be talking about are accelerating black holes and superpositions of different solutions in general relativity. Now, the reason why this is kind of interesting is because gravity is highly nonlinear. So in general, you wouldn't expect to be able to superpose solutions, but to some extent we can. So this is a bit of a story about it's about quirky black holes, perhaps, rather than many black holes. So this is a solution. It's actually been, or in one of its forms, been around for quite some time. But again, I think I was asked when I first wrote down the Kerr metric about, you know, why did people write this down? There was this big drive, as I was saying, in the sort of 60s and 70s to look at exact solutions. And typically they were classified according to the type of symmetries that they had. So here, this is another example where we have, oops, that shouldn't be a y, that should be a phi, where we have two killing vectors, d by dt and d by d phi, but you can see it's structured somewhat differently to Kerr. So again, it depends on two coordinates, x and y, but it's sort of structurally, you know, it's block diagonal, and inside the square brackets, it's kind of quite neatly divided into ty, and x phi. So what I need to do is to tell you what those functions are. Is what's like coordinate?
Cylinder-like.
So phi is meant to be an angular coordinate. So phi has a periodicity.
And the x and y
are not. We're going to explore. X and y are the parameters the metric depends on. So we're going to expect to have to think a bit about them. T, we obviously is associated with a time coordinate and is non-compact. But phi is a compact coordinate. So g and f are not really independent functions. They're the same function, just sort of reflected. So this is a solution. I'm just going to, you can check it for yourselves if you like. This is the solution of the vacuum Einstein's equations. And it's obviously got various places at which we could have either coordinate or physical singularities. So as x goes to minus y, potentially, we've got a problem. So we don't know if it's a physical or coordinate singularity, but all we're doing at the moment is identifying where things might go wrong. And then we've got possible singularities at zeros of f and g. So roughly speaking, these are sort of at x squared or y squared is roughly 1. So as long as GMA is small, that would be the case. And x or y is roughly plus or minus 1 over 2 GMA. So those are the points, those are the places that we're going to focus in on to try and figure out what's going on with this metric. So let's just, that's just written down what the metric is and raise little flags about where we have to keep an eye on. So now let's go in a bit more and think about what, you know, what further things we can say. So if we want to have our Lorentzian signature, we're going to ask that G is positive and F is positive. Okay? So that's sort of digging a bit more. So if I now sketch. So it's a cubic, each of them are cubics. And G is roughly positive, it's positive at x equals 0. It's negative at x equals 1. It's positive at x equals minus 1. And also positive at x equals minus 1 and 2 GMA. So it's this is just a sort of sketch of what G looks like. It's obviously not the scale. I'm just trying to pick out the main points. So here, if I think about looking at the sort of x-phi part of the metric, I want to associate that with a two-sphere. Now, if MA was 0, x would be cos theta. So it's not, so it's like a distorted two-sphere, but topologically it looks like a two-sphere. And therefore, I want my g of x to have two zeros. So if I want to think about my metric as being approximately spherical, or having something that looks approximately spherical, this tells me that I want two roots for G, exactly as I've sketched it here. Now, if I look at the formula for the roots of a cubic, this tells me that I have a limit on the value of GMA. So as I increase GMA, I bring this third, this sort of third zero closer and closer in, and I move these zeros. So I move this zero to the right and the others to the left. And eventually, these two zeros come together and disappear. So it gives me a constraint on the value of this GMA. And then we say, okay, so now I'm going to have X in this range where I'm labeling this zero as X3, this one as X2, and this one as X1. So that's just sort of started by saying, okay, now I know what my range of coordinates is. And I'm beginning to sort of get some imagery to this metric, this formula on the page. I've got some notion of a two-sphere. It's not a two-sphere, but it's sort of like one. So now let's look at the y coordinate. And we want f of y to be positive. So f is minus g of minus y. So that means I want to be essentially in this range here. Because we're flipping, we're kind of doing a rotation, 180 degrees though. Now you could say, I could let my y be sort of in my, you know, negative less than minus x3, but then that would be giving a negative value of y, and there's a reason that I don't want to do that. I want my y to be positive. So, f tending to zero suggests that we've got some sort of horizon, and according to this, we have two places at which f could go to zero. So we've sort of got the notion that this could potentially be a black hole because we've got something that looks like a horizon and the topology of that is spherical in that xy direction. So let me try and convince you a little bit more by doing a change of coordinates. So I'm going to now take a radial coordinate r to be 1 over ay. This is why I wanted y to be positive. And that's really suggested by the location of that horizon. Y is 1 over 2 gma. So that tells us that this r is roughly 2 gm at that particular root. So if I do this, my f of y starts to look extremely familiar. So I've pulled out a factor of y squared in front of the whole sort of bracket. And now you see something that, in fact, looks like that Schwarzschild de Sitter potential. So it's an f of r. I'm just bracketing, just noting that it looks like the Schwarzschild de Sitter divided by a squared r squared. And then dy squared is simply related to dr squared divided by a squared r to the fourth. And we find for our metric so I'm just encoding the x and phi part into this omega tilde. It's not a two-sphere metric, but it's still got features of the two-sphere. So what we've done by this single change of coordinates is taken something that looks rather unpromising or abstract and turned it into something familiar. So this looks like the TR part here is like Schwarzschild de Sitter, where the de Sitter length scale is given by 1 over a. We've also got something that's topologically spherical but distorted. And then overall, we've got a prefactor, what we call a conformal factor, which depends on r and x. So it looks like a distorted Schwarzschild de Sitter black hole. It has two horizons. We've got a sort of black hole type horizon and something that, if it were de Sitter, would be a cosmological horizon. However, I'm putting a question mark next to the cosmological horizon because in de Sitter, the cosmological horizon arises because we have a cosmological constant. Here, I've claimed this is a solution to the vacuum Einstein equations, so there's no cosmological constant. Now, the notation using M and A is entirely deliberate. It's suggestive. It's suggestive that M has something to do with a black hole mass. And A is something that we've got to figure out what it is. It's related to this apparent cosmological horizon, but we don't have a lambda. So what's going on? So the way we figure out what's going on is we isolate the behavior that we're trying to understand. In other words, we want to isolate what the effect of A is. So to isolate A, we set M equal to 0. If we set M equal to 0, our G is now just 1 minus x squared, and therefore this d omega tilde becomes a proper two-sphere metric. So I've now actually said x is cos theta, and I've removed the hat from the t because it's not really relevant. So that, okay, does that look like a flat metric to you?
No.
No, good. I mean, it is. I'm about to show you that it is. But one look at that, if that came in front of you on your desk, you wouldn't say, oh, yes, of course, it's obviously flat, right? It really doesn't look flat at all, okay? So it's It's one of these examples of how many different ways we can write flat space and make it look curved. So I'm going to do yet another coordinate change. So if I just look, if I wanted to make this flat, I'm going to look in at the d phi squared piece here, because that's kind of the one thing that's sort of just sitting there quietly in the background, not doing anything. Here, I've got r squared sine squared theta divided by this conformal factor here. So it sort of suggests that I define some sort of cylindrical radial coordinate to be that g phi, square root of g phi phi. So that's where this one's come from. I'm going to define another coordinate. Now, this is slightly less obvious as to why I would do this without having played a little bit with these things. But I'm going to define another coordinate to be the square root of GTT. So the rationale here is that I'm sort of splitting my four-dimensional space. If I had sort of four R4, I could split my four-dimensional space into two sets of planes. So I could have X, Y, Z, T planes. And in the X, Y planes, I'd have a radial coordinate and an angular coordinate, which is this bit here. And in the ZT planes, I could also imagine that I had a radial coordinate and an angular coordinate. Now, it's not really angular because, of course, this is Lorentzian, but that's kind of the intuition. I'm splitting up R4 into R squared cross R squared. And so in each case, I'm identifying the sort of killing vector component of the metric as a sort of radial coordinate in a two-dimensional subspace. Now, it's not quite true because, of course, we've got r and theta mixing, but that's kind of why I've chosen these two coordinates as kind of intermediaries. Then I set you as an exercise. That our metric boils down, if I do those transformations, to something that's looking an awful lot more promising as being potentially flat space. Now, the rho phi pieces are obviously rewritable as x dx squared plus dy squared, so I kind of feel quite happy about the last bit of that expression. The first bit of the expression is not so obvious. If you look at it as a sort of T, you know, a Lorentzian metric. But again, if I kind of just ignored the A and that was a plus, this would also be polar coordinates. So it's really just an equivalent of polar coordinates for a Lorentzian signature. So in order to see it explicitly, so really, this is just the hyperbolic equivalent of the polar coordinates. And I get flat space. So it wasn't at all obvious from that first writing that this was flat, and I mean genuinely flat space. But just by sort of thinking, well, if it were flat, you know, T and phi are kind of going along for the ride, so GTT and G phi phi should be like radial coordinates. And so using that, you choose new coordinates, and lo and behold, you end up with something that's far more familiar looking. So what is this space-time? Well, if I look at my expression for the original metric and look at r equals 0, so what happens for r equals 0? Well, if I look at that, I've got rho equals 0. From the expression for rho, and if r equals 0, lambda is 1. So, if I now, so I'm at the origin in this xy plane. So if I write the trajectory of the origin of my new coordinates in this flat space, you see that it's actually a non-trivial world line. So if I look at x dot, then I see that my x dot has unit length, which tells me that t is an affine parameter. So t is actually the proper time along that curve. And then x double dot is a squared x, and the length of x double dot is a. So what this tells me is this is a world line of a uniformly accelerating observer. It's accelerating because x double dot is non-zero, so it's not a geodesic. And the magnitude of x double dot is a constant. So now we have an interpretation of the parameter A. A represents an acceleration. So let me sketch what's happening in my t zeta plane, or tau zeta. So this is my world line of r equals 0, and it looks like a hyperboloid. And if I'm uniformly accelerating, then I asymptote this light cone of the origin in these tau zeta xy coordinates. So the horizon now has an interpretation, not as a cosmological horizon, but as what we call an acceleration horizon. as the horizon, because a uniformly accelerating observer will always have a region of space-time that they cannot see. So this space-time here is called Rindler space-time. And rather like the black hole, my Rindler coordinates, so this is my t coordinate, and this is kind of my r coordinate. So the Rindler, we sometimes call it a Rindler wedge, because Rindler covers just one quarter, this sort of one quarter of the plane in the tau zeta directions. It also means that having written it this way, we can see how to extend beyond the acceleration horizon. So I've explicitly, fully analytically extended the Rindler space-time when there's no black hole. Obviously, when there's a black hole, the metric is more complicated, but it still gives you an indicator of how you can extend across that acceleration horizon. So what I kind of want to do now, if I have m non-zero, is I'd like to sort of replace r equals zero by sort of r is roughly 2gm, and I want to sort of replace my observer, accelerating observer, by the black hole event horizon, which would sort of tend to indicate there was another black hole over here. So that's what I kind of, looking at the pictures, that's kind of what I want to do. So now let's see whether that makes sense. Because if I have an accelerating black hole, what is making the black hole accelerate? So sort of sounds a bit, you know, you need a force. Mm-hmm.
Is that why there's another black hole?
Or? That's why there's another black hole, yeah. So now I want to check what happens in the x phi directions. So my d omega tilde squared in general is dx squared on g plus g d phi squared, or proportional to that. Now, I could turn this into a sort of d theta squared by simply integrating up dx on root g. And you can actually do that. That's got an expression in terms of elliptic functions. But it's not particularly helpful. What's important is that if we want to associate this section with some sort of spherical topology, we have to, first of all, close off. So g has to have two zeros. And then we have to look at what happens at each of those zeros of g. So what I'm going to do, and this is going to look awfully familiar after yesterday and the day before, is I'm going to look at what happens as g goes to zero, so at each of those zeros of g, x2 and x3. So near x2 and x3, g is essentially, we can Taylor expand, around the zero. So G is going to zero linearly. And so you've seen this approach when we were looking at the Euclidean sections of the black holes. I'm taking a sort of square root ordinate. So I'm defining theta functions as being proportional to the square root of x minus xi. So d theta I these theta i's are roughly the proper distance away from the zeros of G. So we can think of theta as an angular coordinate. But now, what I've got is I've got this expression near each pole. If this was regular, we would have d theta squared plus theta squared d phi squared, where phi had periodicity 2 pi. So in the case of the Euclidean black hole, we use this as a means of defining the periodicity of Euclidean time. But there was only one zero of G in that of the radial function in that case, at least for all the examples I was showing you. Here we've got two zeros, and so it's not at all clear that we can actually make our metric non-singular. So what I'm going to do is just assume that GMA is small so that I can explicitly expand to leading order in GMA and explore what happens. So my roots are close to x equals 1, plus or minus 1. G primed, if I just work out what G primed is, it's minus 2x, minus 6 GMA x squared. And so each of my poles is roughly plus or minus 1, minus GMA. And so GI primed is Bustle minus 2 minus 4 GMA. So it's not equal to 2, for example. So if G primed was 2, then G squared on 4 would be 1. And so my theta phi part of the metric would be regular. The problem is that each of these phis is different. So it means at least one pole is singular. Metric is singular, yeah. So now we're going to see what that means. So I'm going to choose my phi plus to have 2 pi periodicity. So I'm making the North Pole regular. So if I make one pole regular, the North Pole regular, and then look down to the South Pole, what I see is, so phi tilde now has periodicity 2 pi. So what I'm seeing is that this metric does not seem to be regular. So circles around theta minus equals 0 have a circumference somewhat less than 2 pi r. So this is like a cone. So if I have a cone and take a circle at proper distance r from the top of the cone, the length, the circumference of my circle is not 2 pi r. It's less than 2 pi r. So that is, in fact, a real singularity. It's not just a coordinate singularity. Or if I look at my phi minus coordinate, which is basically a ratio times 5 plus, that has periodicity. Less than 2 pi. In other words, if I draw my sort of space, near theta minus equals 0, then what I see is I don't quite go all the way around the origin. So I've cut out a little wedge of space-time, of space. So this is what a conical deficit singularity is.
It looks to me still like a Croydon singularity.
No, it's a real singularity. You've got a cone, you've got a crease in your space. That's curvature. It's real curvature.
But an infinite curvature, you mean?
Hmm?
An infinite
curvature. Mm-hmm. Yep. So it's a deficit angle. This is a conical singularity. So you basically take a flat piece of paper and you cut a little wedge out of it, and then you re-identify your wedge. And that is a conical singularity. Now, the reason I'm sort of standing up here and being quite blasé about talking about a physical singularity here is that we actually know how to construct these. And they're sort of approximations to some non-singular finite source. So if we have a conical singularity, it's we've cut out an angle in a plane. So it's codimension 2. And so the notion is they have a sharply localized energy momentum. So this is representative of what their energy momentum looks like. Mu is a mass per unit length. So this would be our string running along the z direction. This would be the t coordinate. This would be a z coordinate. And this would be sort of rho phi or theta phi or whatever, x, y. So the energy momentum of one of these strings is very zero or very close to zero in the transverse directions. And you see here that there's sort of the tension equals the energy in terms of the, so it's a bit like a cosmological constant along the directions of the string. So for this, when you look at the Einstein equations for the source, you find it's a conical space-time with a deficit angle of 8 pi g mu. So what this tells us in the context of our metric is that the tension of our cosmic string is just roughly MA. However, if you think about a string under tension, a tension, if you had a sort of the, go way back to sort of school level physics, you know, when you're sort of looking at the properties of a of some sort of wire under tension, at the end, in order to make your wire under tension, you have to provide a force at the end. So if your string is ending on an object, in this case a black hole, then mu is simply the force that is being applied at the end of the string. So this relation here is nothing other than Newton's second law, Newton's law, F equals ma. So the exact solution that they first derived, which was the metric that I wrote down at the beginning, the exact solution has exactly one of these conical singularities. If you don't like singularities, then you can replace it by one of these cosmic strings, which are sort of soliton-type solutions to field theories. So you can sort of smudge it out just a little bit to make it not zero thickness, but just very small thickness. And it's sort of away from the string core. It looks like a conical deficit. And the string itself applies the force that you need in order to accelerate the black hole. So we've now sort of assigned physical meaning to the parameters in this metric. We're associating M to the black hole mass, and we're associating A to an acceleration of the black hole. And we see that in order to make our black hole accelerate, we need to have apply a force, and we do that by pulling it with a string. So pictorially, draw some pictures now. This is what our solution looks like. It's a sort of cartoon. This is my event horizon. This is my cosmic string. I'm accelerating in this direction, and my black hole has uniform acceleration A. So the geometry is known as the C metric, and for the rather prosaic reason that they were classifying the symmetries, sort of classes of symmetry A, classes of symmetry B, and this one came in the class of symmetries of C. So if we draw our maximally extended space-time, we indeed get what I was sketching over there. We find we analytically continue through the future acceleration horizon and the past acceleration horizon, and we see that we've actually got an image black hole in the other part of our space-time. So in reality, what we've kind of got is two black holes that are accelerating away from each other such that they're never in causal contact. Okay? So
So if the tension of the cosmic string depends on M and A?
Yes. Well, I mean, this is just a relation.
Yeah.
In this case, between, I mean, and again, it's approximate for small masses, at least for this particular parameterization of the C metric. So it's simply saying that if you've got the black hole of mass M that's accelerating with constant acceleration A, you must have a string of tension MA.
Okay.
Yep. So, you know, from the if you start with a solution, this is what you deduce the string tension to be. Alternatively, you could say I've got a string of tension mu. I want a black hole of mass m. How fast does it accelerate? And it's constrained. Yeah. So this is sort of It does have, yep.
So is there another end to the string? Is there another end to the string?
No, so the string goes all the way out to infinity. Okay. Yep. In this case, the vacuum case. So the other thing that you can actually do with strings and black holes is you can, this is where I've said they're accelerating, but I could imagine trying to superpose two black holes, sort of to say, well, what happens if I've got two black holes, just space-time with two black holes? Can I have them at a fixed distance apart? Well, the black holes are going to want to attract. So now that I have this intuition of a string providing a restoring force on a black hole, I can now suspend two black holes in equilibrium using cosmic strings. So here I'd have a static space-time. Now there's no, these are now in causal contact. The only snag is, of course, it's an unstable equilibrium. If the black holes nudge a bit closer to each other, the attraction goes up and the string hasn't got enough force to stop them from falling together. If the black holes nudge a little bit away from each other, the gravitational attraction goes down and now the string wins out and it starts to accelerate them away. So this is a sort of, you know, an example where you can have multi-black holes without sort of this supersymmetry, this balancing of charge and gravity. And then just to note as well, we can actually just take a simple solution of a black hole and put a string all the way through it. So it's one of these sort of strange things that the cosmic string is just clean enough gravitationally in order to be able to superpose it and add it to a black hole solution without changing too much. In this case, the conical deficit due to the string is the same on both sides, so there's no net force. You've sort of got MA on one side, or sort of a force on one side, the same force pulling in the opposite direction on the other side. So these are kind of quite interesting exact solutions, and it kind of gives you an example. Normally you would have a sort of tendency to think, I can't superpose solutions in general relativity. I can't add things together. And the answer is, on average, no, you can't. But there are some kind of quite interesting situations where you can. So these are just the simplest possible solutions. You can have many accelerating black holes. You could, you know, using this and this intuition, you could add a second black hole here and an even more tense, bigger tension cosmic string there. So you'd have two accelerating black holes. So there's all sorts of, you know, fun and games that you can play with these solutions. So you'll kind of be seeing this possibly come back when we start looking at higher dimensional gravity and solutions in higher dimensions, because this particular metric was used to construct a rather interesting higher dimensional solution called the black ring. So I think we'll probably be talking about higher dimensional gravity next week, but you will see some of these things again.